Welcome back, everyone, and welcome back to you, Professor Sui Liu.
Thank you. Yes, thank you for having me again.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Back by popular demand. So let me tell you a little bit about Professor Liu. He is the Empire Innovation Professor, the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at the State University of New York at Buffalo. His research includes digital media forensics, computer vision, and machine learning. And we're going to talk about all of that, or at least some of that, today. Professor, we're going to focus on AI and generative AI. We'll talk about some digital media issues as well. But before we get started, I don't think we're that far along in the world of AI to assume that everyone knows what generative AI is. So I know that in language models, it's a model that predicts the next word in a sentence based on the previous word. But I'm guessing that's a pretty simplistic explanation. So what is generative AI?
Well, generative AI is a new trend in artificial intelligence. And it was actually used, it's relatively recent. And the time we use generative AI is in contrast with a more traditional form of AI, which I will call analytical AI. So in analytical AI, the target is to basically come up with an answer from an input. Say, somebody asks a question, say if this image contains a human face or it's a cat or it's a dog, then the AI model will tell you yes or no. So basically give assertive answer to certain questions. While generative AI, on the other hand, is making up stuff. So you can tell the AI model now, instead of answer a question, say, if this sentence contains a question about a certain opinion, is this, like this comment is on Amazon review, means this customer likes a product or not. On the other hand, the generative AI will say, write me a comment about this product and expressing my, appreciation. I like this product. Write a piece of comments like that. So generative AI is a new trend of AI. They're making things instead of just answering questions. Yes.
So, and appreciate that. Thanks, Professor. And that makes sense to me. When I think of analytical AI, I'm thinking that our research models, Lexis, Westlaw, Case Text, where I can insert a prompt and there is this corpus of case law, and using a Boolean search or a prompt, I can then receive from that model the most relevant cases. But they're not that model isn't creating anything that doesn't already exist. So let's talk about generative AI that creates things that don't exist. And my next question is, what happened? I mean, last summer, no one knew anything about ChatGPT. No one knew what generative AI was or is. And then in November 2022, OpenAI launches ChatGPT. And now all of a sudden, we all have to figure out how this is relevant to our lives and how we can incorporate it into our lives and businesses. I know it didn't happen overnight. Can you just walk us through how it did happen? How was it that last fall we all became introduced to generative AI?
That's a great question. I think all this is actually an accumulation of many years of research in this area. The public only become aware of generative AI starting, as you mentioned, November of last year. We probably just passed a bit over 1 year mark of the development of coming to the public awareness of generative AI. But this area of branch of artificial intelligence has been under very active development for at least 10 years, if not even more. This is actually when we started artificial intelligence. Analytical AI and generative AI are two branches going in parallel and sort of borrowing area from each other and encouraging each other, promoting each other too. So these are the two, basically mapping back to two, basic activities of human intelligence or human brains are dealing with. You know, in the real world, we have to deal with analytical stuff. We have to make decision, you know, on a daily basis. You know, should I turn left or right, you know, at this crossing when I'm driving? But we also need to come up, we also need to do a lot of things that are creative, requires, you know, original thinking, and those are generative intelligent behaviors. So this is, ever since the AI, artificial intelligence, becomes a research area, people start to get interested in both analytical and generative branches of it. So I think the earliest example of generative AI I can think of is probably from the early 2000s, when people are making AI models to recreate patches of images that look like real images. It was very primitive, but it was like a baby step, but it's a revolutionary, because back then people already, researchers have already started to think about how to use AI models to recreate what we experience in real world. And what happened is, you know, that has most of the development of generative AI have been behind the scenes for, you know, number one, the results are really not that well, good to be presented. On the other hand, I think it's also the limitation of computation resources and data many of other technical factors. So it's all this development in it's like in many other fields, especially in AI, where the development is like exponential. So before we reach certain threshold, it's always under the scene, you know, under the surface. And it was last year, last November, when OpenAI finally opened up this ChatGPT, that would make it public. And a lot of people can play with it. Then we're suddenly aware that we have that capacity. But the precursor of ChatGPT, which is known as the GPT model, I've tested play with the system, I think as early as 2020. And they have a GPT version 1.0, GPT 2.0, and ChatGPT is based on 3.0, sorry. So I have seen two previous versions of that, and I can literally see the improvement of the generative quality across different versions. Yes. So there are a lot of previous development behind the scenes, under the surface. And November 2022 was the time that, you know, the technology is finally sophisticated and mature enough that the users, common user, can start to appreciate.
Right. The moment that we all saw the tip of the iceberg, and I've used it as well. I've used it to create lists of questions, mm-hmm. more or less out of curiosity. Mm-hmm. I know some have rather infamously used it to conduct legal research, which has turned out to result in hallucinations that have gotten more than a couple of lawyers into some very serious trouble. We're going to talk about some of the dangers of generative AI in a moment. But first, can you just give us a sense? I know your focus, although you're very familiar with large language models, your focus has been in the digital media realm. Give us some examples. If we're sitting here in early 2024 and you're looking out onto the horizon, what are some of the uses that you expect will be mainstreamed as opposed to uses that are confined to large corporations and maybe research institutions like UB?
That's a wonderful question. If I have a looking glass into the future, yeah. I will say, you know, definitely one of the major trends will be the personalization of the large language models. Right now we're at the mercy of whatever OpenAI come up with their ChatGPT model trained on the whole corpus of internet. But I think, to make ChatGPT type of large language models more useful for ordinary users, and I will say particularly professionals, you know, like lawyers, corporate executives, you know, whoever have a special need of, you know, a context, ChatGPT will become more tailored to that sort of corpus. So, you know, like, you know, I want a ChatGPT like a personal assistant to me and be able to help me writing simple emails or template, you know, formatted documents in my writing style. Then I think is going to, you know, I will have such a GPT model that will learn from all the materials I wrote in the past and then come up with something that really reads like what I wrote. And that will make the model a lot more useful than at the current level. And this is already happening. GPT, OpenAI is actually opening up an API where, you know, you can provide your own training data set and personalize or specialize the GPT model to come up with things that, you know, more aligned with your particular requirement and context. So I think that's definitely one trend. The other trend is you talk about, you know, interface between different modalities. So just come up with text is one thing, but we also want to understand, you know, interfaces between modalities, because the social media, the internet is by its very nature multimedia. So we have not only text, we also have images, we have audios, we have videos, right? So I think another big trend I will see, I will predict, is this interfacing between different media modalities, from images, videos, and audios to text. For instance, ChatGPT already, the current GPT-4 model already have a visual module where you can upload an image and it will say something, it can answer your questions about the images. I'm assuming this will become very useful, especially say, you know, for particular legal context. There is a recording of a court case, like two or long, right? But we may not have time to actually see through the two or video. So we can ask models like large language model to say, give me a summarized highlights of this video of tours down to like 5 minutes. So I'll be able to read through this and also, take out highlight moments from the video and compress that into a short highlight video. So I can watch that part and also accompany that with a short text description of all these highlights. And things can also go the other way. Say, you know, we already have models like tools like Stable Diffusion, Midjourney, that give me text to create images. But we can also have something like, you know, give me text and create audios and videos. So this will also actively develop in the research community. So I'm predicting, you know, sometime within the year of 2024, we'll start to see some reliable system that creating short clips of videos that will help us based on the text input we have. Let's say maybe somebody will say, give me a video that Kevin say this, and then, you know, just put a text. I want you to say certain things, and then we'll create a video of you saying those.
When you're talking about interfacing between different modalities, that's one example. So I have text, but I want to enliven that text with audio or video. You can create a video or an audio that in which I'm actually speaking that text, and I may also appear as the person speaking that text. Yes. And I don't necessarily, so I don't even have to record it. What would you need technically to make that happen? I know we were talking a little bit about something like this offline. I was telling you that I had recorded a piece of micro content for LinkedIn, but I was driving. I was paying attention to the road, but I was driving and we decided, you know what, we're not gonna show a video of me driving and speaking at the same time.
Right.
And you said, well, if you give me a video or a photo of you, we can combine those resources into a video in which you're not in the car speaking, you're in your office or in another place. Yes. Is that what you mean by the interface of different modalities?
Yeah, that's one side, you know, from text, some existing contents to audiovisual content. So there's several levels of that. I'll say the simplest level is you give me a, if I have a soundtrack of you talking, you just don't have you, your visual, your video of speaking those words. There are AI tools called lip syncing. So, you know, the easiest one is I can take a video, say the video we're doing now, mm-hmm. and then I can use that AI tool can be used to create essentially, you know, the shapes of your lips in a video to match up with the input audio. So I can take your audio track, run through the AI algorithm, mm-hmm. generate the you know your lips as you're speaking those words, and paste it back into your video like this one, and then it will have the impression as you were actually there, you know, talking, you know, speaking those words, and that's the easiest one to do. Mm-hmm. Or you know, slightly more sophisticated, I can take a single image of you, and I can use that algorithm to create again the lip shapes, and then I can recreate your face movement and lip movement just based on one image. The quality will not be as, you know, it will not be as realistic or natural as if I have the video, original video, but it will, you know, for casual viewers, or you just want to put it on as an impression of you're talking there, and it's pretty decent. So that's called talking hat generation.
Right.
Or even more, if I can have just a text of you speaking certain things, I can have your voices as training data, then I can make a model. That's called a text-to-speech. I can start with the text, creating your voice, and then align your voice with the video. Okay, so I can now start with text to do that. And even more sophisticated, you give me an idea, I can run something like a large language model, create a text, and then make your voice speaking those words, and then make your video and align with those voices. So almost like you give me an idea, say, make Kevin say these things. I can go through this whole pipeline to make a whole video. You're actually speaking, you know, extensively, not just this, give a full description of this idea. Right. And the end result will be a video, you talking those words.
All right. So I'm thinking if I have a colleague who's no longer with us, but I have audio, this colleague mm-hmm. making presentations and training. Mm-hmm. And I should say, when I mean no longer with us, I'm using the euphemism, this colleague has passed on, so is no longer with us, but he meant so much to us, and assuming we have all the consents, we want to create new presentations with yes. this person giving them. I'm no longer here, but you can create a video in which I'm giving a new presentation based on content that we can generate from text. And it can look like I'm actually delivering that presentation.
Right. Yes, indeed. Yes, that's one of the most advanced generative AI tools can provide us with. Yeah.
But, and we should get to this now, but I suppose if in the wrong hands, someone, there's lots of video out there of President Biden and lots of audio. Someone who's not out to do good could take that video and audio and create a speech in which the president declares war on one of our adversaries. And that, at the very least, would create a tremendous amount of confusion, if not a response from the enemy country. So if that's the case, and if that's where we're headed, Professor Liu, what guardrails do you recommend for this digital technology or generative AI? How do we come up with a set of rules and guidelines to make sure that we're all running 1,000 miles an hour learning this new technology, that we use it for good and not for ill?
I think, yeah, that's a question a lot of people ask me. You know, it's really a pressing need to make sure that, you know, this technology is being used only for beneficial purposes. I think fundamentally, this is also the main the main objectives of the executive order from the White House, or I think in October, is putting guardrails to generative AI technologies, because a lot of people are becoming aware of the potential negative uses of this technology. As you mentioned, spreading disinformation using famous faces. And there are already real-world incidents of that. You know, I recently just got called on by a reporter from Reuters, and they identify fake videos of President Biden not talking about, you know, starting a war, but really talking about, you know, giving every American, you know, $5,000 for nothing. You know, just
right.
It's a disinformation. It's a fake video, and with his voice, his faces, and looks real. So I think, you know, fundamentally, first of all, everybody, you know, making this kind of contents need to become responsible for declaring the nature of the content we're spreading. For instance, if I, you know, I'm contracted to make a video of you saying certain things, I wouldn't just, you know, spread it out online and telling everybody this is what Kevin said. That will be, you know, that'll be the improper use of this technology. More importantly, I think what should be done is, you know, always come with a disclaimer, with a declaration that this content is created with the consent from the subject using AI algorithms. So it's almost like, you know, we watch a movie, and the movie, you know, somewhere in the movie it will say this is based on a real story. It would never say this is a real story, right? Of course, people come to movie knowing that this is not the real event, but we should always tell them that, you know, something has been changed from the original sequence of events in the movie. Same thing happened for AI generated contents. We need to declare that this is not a real event, real video, but it's created with the help of AI algorithms. And at the same time, you know, that's from the responsibility part. From the technical part, the models we use should also, you know, take some measures. For instance, the executive order from the White House talking about putting watermarks into the synthetic contents coming out of the generative AI tools. And also, you know, we can also put in certain fingerprints, extract fingerprints from the generative contents and store it somewhere, so future on when the synthetic content is being distributed, we have a way to verify, yes, this is coming from this model, from this tool.
Right.
And also, we should also develop detection technologies. That's my research, you know, so that in a short period of time, how could we make sure, you know, this content, if nobody declared, because, you know, we are not expecting everybody to become responsible, especially when we're talking right. about, you know, foreign countries or, you know, criminals, they're intended to use this irresponsibly. So in that case, we need to have a way to be able to tell, yes, this come from an AI, generative AI tools, mm-hmm. or no, this is actually a real video recording.
I was going to ask you about that, Professor. Is there a way for you or your colleagues to look at a video and determine whether it's genuine or created by artificial intelligence?
Yes, there are ways to do that. We have technical detection algorithms, bunch of them. So we can run through those detection algorithms of any input audiovisual media. And based on their signal signatures, we can tell their differences because, again, you know, something come from a particular generative AI tools will carry certain type of features, certain type of attributes that we can use. It's just that those attributes may not be directly visible to human eyes or, you know, audible to human ears. So these algorithms are like X-rays. They can show those hidden features to
right.
us. We also developed, you know, along the years, because I've seen a lot of this synthetic contents, I also developed certain, you know, you can say I have trained eyes to look for certain mm-hmm. things or to listen to certain features to see that. And that's really, you know, these days, a significant fraction of my work is to help journalists and investigators to identify, expose synthetic contents and provide evidence for that. Yes, so we're working on that, yeah.
Can you tell, for example, because you mentioned journalism, I wonder if you can tell, for example, in watching a video that's by and large going to be edited for a television broadcast, is it possible to watch that video and using one of those algorithms you mentioned, determine whether the video has been edited, where it's been edited? So if you're looking at, sometimes the edits are obvious, but can you tell whether there's been a subtle edit to a video so that people watching can know whether what they're seeing is actually a fair representation of what actually happened?
Well, in principle, we can. That's, you know, this whole research area called media forensics is for. So we're developing algorithms to help people to identify those subtle signs of editing or, you know, AI generation. But in practice, you know, it's a very challenging problem. And especially when the change are small and you know, not very significant, the algorithm need to be very accurate about, you know, where the video was actually edited or, you know, manipulated. So, you know, most of the detection algorithms are statistical in nature, so they give you an answer, but not deterministic answer. So it's the algorithm is used to help us narrow down the scope to look for roughly this area, or, you know, this one with sufficient doubt about its origin. Then human expert coming in, look for those evidence and come up with a more concrete conclusion about the nature of the synthetic video. So right. Yes, I mean, it's a combination, it's a collaboration between algorithms and human examiners.
Right.
At the same time. But there, you know, to a short answer to a question, there are ways, but, you know, we're not there yet. That's why we're working on research
in this area. That's what people like you are working on, and I hope we do get there, and I hope there's an interest in it, because I think you play an important role in helping us judge the value and the content of the information we get. In the time we have left, Professor, I wanted to ask you, you know, since ChatGPT came to market in November 2022, there have been a lot of well-known organizations rushing their competing AI products to market. And some of them are open, but some of them are closed in the way that you mentioned earlier, that an organization may have its own AI, its own generative AI system that helps it perform its unique functions. So, I mean, there are upwards of a dozen, I think we may be up to almost 20 AI services now. You can get them from Google, Microsoft, IBM, Amazon. And everyone listening may have a different type of business. So I'm an attorney in a law firm. There are healthcare providers, there are manufacturers. If someone's sitting in a weekly meeting now, Professor, and they're saying, boy, you know, I see all these AI products out there. Everyone else is looking at this. We should think about whether AI products can help us perform our business faster, more efficiently. How should an organization go about thinking about that and selecting a vendor? I take it, you don't just go out and say, oh, I just got this message from Microsoft, I'm going to order their product and we'll be off and running. But I think a lot of organizations just don't know where to start. And I know that many law firms are working on this issue now and other organizations too. So, Professor, what advice do you have for us? If we know a generative AI is out there, we want to explore how it can help us perform various parts of what we do. Where do we start to think about whether generative AI can help us, what vendor we should use, and what guardrails we should have in place?
Well, I think, that's, again, very good question. I think to start with, generative AI, you know, even though it's very powerful, is still a tool. So the intention of using the tool start with the actual practical uses. So it needs to be grounded in real needs of an organization. So I think the first step is actually go back and look through the work the whole workflow of, you know, the organization, and look for steps where, you know, they are repeated, formatted, and, you know, requires certain repetitive, you know, editing, you know, writing. Those are the places where generative AI tools, especially like things like GPT, will be mostly helpful, because the GPT model basically learned from a huge corpus of text. You know, this is called the training set. And that training set is contains all the information it can use to create a text, an article. And if the more formatted the end result needs, the easier, you know, the model will come up with something that is, you know, readable and you know, natural. So I think, you know, these number one, I would suggest is looking for the need. Where do you actually need it, right? Because a lot of places is you don't need too much of variations. Most of the time is just following certain formats. And having somebody have to type in everything and write everything will become, you know, less efficient. That's where the generative AI tools, especially large language models, will be most helpful. Now, comparing different models, I think there are a couple of different, you know, factors you can think about. But, you know, to me, most of the AI providers, large language model becomes very expensive. So you actually do not have a lot of, you know, vendors who have the capacity of running from scratch, train a large language model to and provide it as a service. So between the major players, I would say the difference is actually quite subtle, because it's really about the volume of data you use. And the architecture they're using are all sophisticated and complicated enough, that complex enough that I think the difference are not significant. But the difference lies in, you know, how much they can be flexible towards your organization's need. Like, can they open up and adapt quickly to a particular corpus that of your interest, right? And number two is response time, you know, how well, you know, they can get change along the way. So you put in, like in ChatGPT, you say, I don't like this, change the style a little bit. How fast, how many, you know, in terms of number of iterations you need to make the model aware that the style need to be changed to satisfy your requirement. I think number three is related with your last point, is the safeguard. It's about hallucination. You know, when you give them the space of creation, making up things, how much of the stuff that will come up with that does not comply with, you know, set up rules or, you know, laws. Those are very important, because, you know, I would say if the model is more conservative, if you know, on one side it's less come up with some new things, but on the other side it also it reduced the need and the effort from human to actually look at, you know, what is created from the model and correct what is wrong. So I think this is a few factors you can throw in to decide on this. But the best way to do that is have a specific set of tasks, run in parallel, see, you know, compare the results, right, and see, you know, come up with data, and then do you can do a better comparison there.
You want to be able to compare each service provider with the common text, just so you can compare apples to apples.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, Professor Liu, thank you so much. I know you've got to run, but I think that generative AI is going to be a game changer for all of our listeners and our businesses across the country, but there are potential risks. And the more we understand about it, the more we understand how to use it responsibly and how to select the vendors that provide it, I think the more successful we're going to be. And the organizations that figure that out first are unquestionably going to have a leg up on their competitors.
Absolutely, yes.
All right, Professor Liu from the State University of New York at Buffalo, thank you so much for coming back. I really enjoyed talking with you about generative AI. I hope you'll come back to talk to us again sometime soon.
Thank you so much for having me. Yes, it's my pleasure. Yes.
Thank you. And Thanks to all of you. We'll be back soon with another episode.
The CyberSIP podcast is available on BarclayDamon.com, YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Like, follow, share, and continue to listen.